Okay, so we saw from the ideal postulates that we described transformations by unitary operators. Transformations in time are generated by a Hamiltonian. So the unitaries of the form e to the iht. And now, as we did for measurements and for states, we're going to consider two physical scenarios where the transformation cannot be described as a unitary. So case one is we'll consider mixtures of unitaries. So this is the same idea as before. I'll assume it's pretty straightforward. If you have any questions, please interrupt me. But basically, we assume we can have a transformation. So here, let's call this rho in and rho out. So the ideal case is that lambda rho is equal to u rho u dagger. Here lambda is called a superoperator. So in the ideal case, this superoperator, which transforms rho in to rho out, so lambda is a map from the linear operators on CD to the linear operators on CD. But more generally, if transformation UI is applied with probability PI, then we can have lambda on rho is equal to a sum over I pi ui rho ui dagger. So note that this is a linear map. So let's define some operators A sub I. I guess I'm calling it J here, but it doesn't really matter. As the square root of pi ui. Then we have this compact form, lambda rho is equal to a sum over I ai rho ai dagger. Yeah?
Just to connect this to the homework,
the
notation I was using, that lambda was curly e and the a was capital A.
Okay. Sure. Alternate notation. But sure. So now let's look at the properties. So let's remark that first of all, the map lambda is a linear map. It's a linear map from the it's taking the linear operators on CD to the linear operators on CD. But it itself is a linear map. And the second remark is that observe that the AI satisfy sum over I, AI dagger AI is equal to identity. You can check that. All right, so let me do an experiment with this blackboard. Now, case two is more interesting. Case two is what's going to give rise to, I'll say this later. So case two is that we have a unitary interaction between the system of interest and some ancilla system . So here U, which I'll put int at top to remind you it's some kind of coupling between the two systems. U is then a map that takes linear operators. Sorry, U takes states. So U actually takes states. So it takes H A B to HAB, which is equal to HA tensor HB. But now the point is, here the whole motivation here is that we're just interested in describing the system of interest. We can always just describe this process in the Hilbert space HAB. I hope you guys are going to use some handwriting. Sorry, that's a little bit not quite as clean as I'd like to do it. I'll try and clean that up. The whole point is we can always describe this as a unitary using the ideal axioms, the ideal postulates, acting on this bigger Hilbert space. But for various reasons, you want some description just on the system of interest. So we want the description of this as an effective interaction, as an effective transformation acting only on the system of interest. Which is our Hilbert space HA. So given what you've covered in the tutorials and the homework assignments, is this just too basic, or do you think this is still valuable to get this big overview? Is that a yes to too basic?
No.
Or yes to getting the careful picture. Okay, so I'm going through this carefully. You can see where it comes from. So then how do we describe this? Okay, so let's do this. So then what we want to do is we want to say, look, I have rho A tensor sigma B, and I'm going to apply some unitary. Here I'm going to have too many superscripts. The uint is a bit redundant, I guess, so let me just drop it. And it'll be obvious from context, hopefully. And then we're going to discard description of the ancilla system. So we're going to do a partial trace. And then that will be row A out. Row A out. So this is row A in, row A out. So pictorially, we have row A, we have sigma. Okay, I really ought to be consistent with my notation here. Let me just call this row. So we have row, we have sigma, we have some interaction of some sort, and then now they are, of course, entangled. So this scribbly means interaction. And this means that the systems are now coupled. Or entangled, correlated, yes. Oh, okay. And then what we do is we throw away this system. Sorry, that's supposed to be a garbage can. So this is the trash. Now we're not actually throwing the system away. Well, maybe we are, but more importantly is that we're just not interested in describing it anymore. So we care about just system A out. So we care about row out. And so let's analyze this expression. So first, let's do a couple things. First, for simplicity, let's assume that sigma is just equal to 0, 0 on system B. Let's just define it as some pure state. Okay, so we could always include the mixed state case, we just have an extra sum we'd be carrying around. Okay, then what we can do is we can define an operator A sub k as k u 0. Then we can now evaluate this partial trace. So here, let k be an orthonormal basis for HB. And then, you know, k equals 0 is just our 0 state. Then we have that rho out is equal to lambda rho in, which is equal to a sum over k ak rho in ak dagger. Where lambda is a linear superoperator. And where the AK satisfy, and you can just check this via direct computation, the AK satisfy sum over K, AK dagger, AK is equal to identity. What Hilbert space is this identity on? HA, right. Okay. So let's a definition, and you've seen this already. The set of operators A sub K, a set of operators A sub k satisfying sum over k. There's no constraints on non-negativity or anything like that. These are just arbitrary linear operators. I should define these as linear operators. Each ak is a linear operator from the Hilbert space H to itself. Such that lambda rho is equal to a sum over k ak rho ak dagger. For some linear super operator lambda is called a Krauss operator decomposition. Or a Krauss operator sum. Any questions about that so far? Yes.
Is there a difference between this and a BODM?
Yes. Well, if you remember the notation I was using, the letter, the capital E letter,
yep,
that is a POVM element. So POVM is a set of those things. Those are positive operators.
Yep.
These are not positive operators.
Right, but every positive operator can be written for, like,
correct. So if you do that, whatever that decomposition is called, the polar decomposition or whatever, what's it called? If you do that decomposition where you write EK as MK, MK dagger, or MK dagger, MK, I can't remember which way it goes. If you do that decomposition, then you get a set of Krauss operators. But they won't sum to identity. They'll sum to less than identity. What is the sum? Why do we impose the constraint that AK dagger, AK, not impose, but we derived this property that AK dagger, AK, sum over K is equal to identity? What physical property led to that condition on the AKs? Exactly. But a single POVM element corresponds to a conditional map. So if I put in 1,000 systems into my apparatus, 15% of the time I get some outcome K equals 1. That decomposition of that POVM element E sub 1, or K, the K equals 1 outcome, is a non-trace preserving because it corresponds to 150 out of those 1,000 systems. So I've lost systems if I'm just post-selecting on a particular outcome. But then when you include all of the POVM elements, you do get a trace preserving. So those are the issues. This is actually a point in the lecture, which I'll now skip. Okay, that's where this guy dies, so I'll move over here. Great.
Are these the same as the generalized Krauss operators that we had in our homework one?
Yes, I don't think they're called generalized. I mean, the Krauss operators, yeah.
When you have a probabilistic mixture of, I mean, the one you could write as a probabilistic.
Well, that's a special case.
Mixture of non-unitary.
So that's case one, I guess, that we were talking about. But case two is the more. Oh, yeah, so general in that sense.
Yeah.
So, okay, now this is some definitions. Any linear superoperator satisfying complete positivity Did you cover this discussion of complete positivity? Did you discuss complete positivity? Okay, good. Okay. Is called a completely positive map. So complete positivity is the following condition. We have some state rho AB, which is obtained via acting okay, now I'm going to introduce a funny notation for you. Okay, so what's going on here? Why did I put two hats on these? Okay, so here's what's happening. Lambda, as we've seen, is a superoperator which takes linear operators to linear operators. Lambda takes linear operators on HA. What this means is I put two hats on the identity. I'm using two hats because things can get confusing. Because we have, in HB, we have the identity operator in HB. So this symbol, which is equal to the same symbol with a hat, because we're dropping hats now, because we've gotten to the point where we just recognize when a symbol represents a linear operator, and that means it has a hat on it. So these guys are elements of the linear operators on, say, some Hilbert space H. If I put two hats on the identity, that means it's the identity superoperator. So this guy is the identity superoperator. Okay, so the number one is the identity operator acting on, means it, you know, does nothing under multiplication. So the identity superoperator does nothing when it acts on the Hilbert space. So this is an element. So this, it takes linear operators on H to themselves. So it's a linear operation. It's a linear superoperator from the linear operators on H to linear operators on H. And in particular, it's the one that does nothing. So basically, identity acting on rho just gives you rho again. For every rho, well, actually, it's for every linear operator. So let me use the symbol A. For every A, what do you guys want as a symbol for just a generic linear operator? No physical significance, just some mathematical object.
G?
No, I'm rejecting G. I'm going with O. O. So I'll put a single hat on it. For every O, which is an element of the linear operators on the Hilbert space. Okay, so this is something you have to get a little bit comfortable with. It's a very useful way to think about things. So the double hat means it's an identity superoperator. So complete positivity is saying the following. So the notation here is that I have some input state. Let me use hats now because the context is a bit murky. I have some entangled or correlated state of system AB. I act on the A part with lambda, and I do nothing to the B part. And I get an output state on system AB. So this is what complete positivity, it means that complete positivity means that rho AB is a positive operator rho AB at time t is if rho AB, the input, so O and 0 and t are just like in and out here. So if I put in other words, what this is saying is that if I put in a valid density operator, I get out a valid density operator. So we say that the map lambda is completely positive if this is true. Now remark, contrast, so just as a remark, we say that lambda is a positive map where lambda takes some row in to row out if row out is non-negative when row in is non-negative. So just the action of the lambda super operator, here I'll use my notation here to make sure we're clear. If you take some map lambda and you give it a valid state and it spits out a valid state, we say that's a positive map. But what's interesting is that you can have positive maps, so maps that are valid if they act on a state, which are not completely positive, which means that if I give them half of an entangled state and do nothing on the ancilla system, the output state is not positive. So think about what that means physically. If I tell you, here's a box, so physically what this means I have my transformation box, and I'm putting row in, and I get out row out. So clearly, if this is a physical transformation, we have to have physically valid statistics, and we do measurements on row out, which means that lambda must be positive. But nothing's stopping me from taking some preparation, and this produces rho in, and I put this into a box. So this is HB, and this is HA. So I have some joint preparation W. So W is a density operator on HA tensor HB. And then here, this is the identity super operator on the linear operators on HB. And then I recombine the systems and I put them into some measurement box. So here's my pointer, my light. So this transformation lambda, if I acted on half of an entangled pair, or any input state for that matter, but the interesting case is when they're entangled, then I want the final state, when I recombine the systems, to still be a valid physical state. And what's kind of surprising when you first see this is that there are some mathematical quantities lambda, which are well-defined positive operators mathematically, for which when you act on half of an entangled state and you recombine the systems and you measure it, you get negative probabilities. Which are of course physically meaningless at this level, because here we're describing the actual relative frequency of outcomes of events, and that can't be negative. So then we say, we add this additional condition, so condition A is that lambda must be positive, and condition B is that lambda must be completely positive. Otherwise, it can't correspond to a valid physical transformation, or we would get something physically meaningless. Like, you know, a relative frequency of -3 for outcome k equals 7. Yes?
Your definition of positivity and completely positive over there. Am I right in thinking the completely positive thing is an if and only if statement? But why is it kind of like,
is it what statement?
If and only if.
Yeah, I mean, this is a bit clumsy. I would say, I should just say, I could combine these two definitions into one and say the linear superoperator is a completely positive map if this is true. That's probably much cleaner. I don't know why I did it this way, but there's probably some reason, but I can't remember. Yeah, okay. I mean, I wouldn't say that. I mean, that's correct in some highly qualified sense. If I think of rho AB as a representation of a quantum system and I give you all the postulates of quantum mechanics, then yes. But mathematically, rho AB being greater, but this is actually a mathematical statement. This is not a physical statement. So, I mean, rho AB being greater than or equal to zero, what it exactly means is that psi rho AB psi is greater than or equal to zero for every psi in the Hilbert space. And it, a consequence of that is that you get that your probabilities are, that under the Born rule, you get probabilities. No, this is not a trace. This is just saying that, I mean, this is, think of this, okay, you're thinking physics, think math, okay? This is just a mathematical statement. I have vectors in a space, I have an operator on that space. We call that operator a positive operator if it satisfies this condition, which is not a physical operation, it's just a mathematical constraint.
Okay,
and,
I was curious about the identity superoperator.
Mm-hmm. You can, yeah. Exactly. It'd be one term, and you'd have an identity on each side.
I just have what should be a really quick map checkup question. Make sure. Following. Completely positive maps are a subset of positive maps?
Yes, correct.
Okay. And so even for a single system, then, we require that our maps are completely positive, even if positivity might be, like in that first case up there where you're just measuring one system and you say that says lambda must be positive, we still wouldn't allow a positive but not completely positive map? Or
you wouldn't allow it, it turns out mathematically those are really interesting maps and they're going to be a criterion for entanglement, but it doesn't represent a valid physical process. It's not something I can go build in the lab.
A positive but not completely positive.
Correct. So I can't build a box. I can't build a box that where lambda is a positive but not completely positive map. Okay. I can do it on MATLAB, but I can't put a physical system into it and get out a physical system. Otherwise, I would get negative probabilities, which are meaningless. The theory would not be self-consistent if that was the case. Yeah, because I think the point is positivity applies to operators which don't necessarily diagonalize. Like you have operators where you have a singular value decomposition, but not a diagonalization. So this is a very broad term, but typically we're only interested in operators that diagonalize because they're unitary or they're self-adjoint, and then it does correspond to that. So in practice, yes, but in general, no. That sounds familiar. Okay, so I mean, getting used to superoperators is something that is useful because it's the correct description of the actual things that can happen in the universe, or in the lab, or for that matter. So you often hear people talking about things like, oh, if we describe the black hole this way, then we can't use a unitary transformation to describe it, and so therefore it's not physically valid. Well, really, you want to talk about completely positive maps as the most general allowed transformation. And it turns out, here's the bad news, most people will tell you completely positive maps are the correct way to describe physical transformations, the most general description. I've given it to you as a postulate, and it's actually false. there is a more general thing that can happen, and sadly, we don't have a mathematical formalism to describe it. So this is, you know, this is, I'll tell you exactly what I'm talking about right now, actually, but let me take a question first.
I'm just trying to get around the difference between super operators and regular operators. They both map from, the operators on your Hilbert space to the operators on your Hilbert space. So super operators map from operators on your Hilbert space to operators on your Hilbert space, as opposed to regular operators map from your Hilbert space to Hilbert space.
Yeah, okay, that's a good point. And actually, let me make a mathematical statement that's, once I understood this, all of this stuff became completely trivial, and so let me tell you about it. So this is a very useful fact. I can't spell useful, apparently. A very useful fact.
Every super operator corresponds to another multiplication by an operator?
No. So I'm not saying that's not a useful fact. I'm just saying that's not the useful fact I'm going to tell you. So a very useful fact is the following. So I didn't even hear completely what you said. So the set of linear operators acting on a Hilbert space, let's, for simplicity, just assume it's finite dimensional, so we can put a number on it, d, as the dimension. And of course, just to remind you, we've been denoting which we denote as LCD. Let me just put an H here instead. The set of linear operators acting on the Hilbert space. This is our Hilbert space of Schrodinger wave functions, for example, or states, quantum pure states, is itself a Hilbert space. I shouldn't use this, I need a prime or something. Let's call it H2 equal to CD squared. Okay, this is really cool. So what that means is that, I'll tell you more about this in a minute, the linear superoperators that act on the density operators are themselves just linear operators. So the fact that we're using the word super is just as a, it's mathematically imprecise but conceptually useful. It's telling us, what's the operational space we're talking about? Are we talking about a linear operator on pure states or a linear operator on mixed states? So super operator is a linear operator on the space of density operators, and operator is, so it's just a designation, but they're all just, a linear super operator is just a linear operator. And so now here's a pop quiz. If I'm telling you that it's a Hilbert space, what have I not told you to specify what that Hilbert space is? Norm, they're very close. That's correct, but not what I'm looking for. Inner product. What's the inner product, right? So I have to tell you, with inner product, so mathematically, there's lots of notations for inner product. So let's do it this way. We'll just use the standard Dirac notation. So here it's important to realize that A is a linear operator on CD, as is B. So B and A comma B. So these guys are linear operators. So we need some object. Remember, what is an inner product? Because we're talking about Hilbert spaces, we have a dual space that's isomorphic to the original Hilbert space. So we designate that with a bra. So A here, A is in the dual space, which means it's a linear functional that takes elements of the Hilbert space to scalars. So here, B is a linear operator, and I'm telling you it's an element of a Hilbert space. So B is a ket and A is a bra, and you act on B with A, which is a linear functional taking B, which is an element of the linear operators, to a scalar. So trace A dagger B gives you a scalar, and in general it's a complex number. Now, because it's confusing, because people don't like to use hats, so strictly speaking, I should call these guys A hat and B hat, just to remind you that they're linear operators. Also, this does that. So because this is the Dirac notation for pure states, and you might think, oh, is A here some pure state? And he's just using a funny symbol. Usually I use psi or phi to represent a pure state. But so often when people replace this notation with a notation, just like we put two hats on guys that are linear operators to remind you which Hilbert space they're acting on, people will use a different notation here. They'll use a double, they'll double up the brackets to remind you that these symbols inside this refer to linear operators acting on your space of pure states. So this is just a notation. So you just use some notation so that you know what you're talking about, what your symbols mean, so it's like a reminder of what they mean. But it doesn't matter what notation you use. Yeah.
So if we have mixed states, this would be a way to calculate something corresponding to the overlap of pure states?
Overlap of a mixed state with a pure state.
So this the overlap is like
this, and you asked earlier about this guy right here. We could think of this as an inner product between the projector psi and the mixed state rho. So for example, this can be rewritten as so let me make my symbols bigger so that there's so I've written this positivity condition as an inner product. And so if you all want to unpack this, remember the adjoint, A has a dagger on it because it's in the dual space. But positive operators are self-dual. So they're adjoint, they're self-adjoint in particular is what I mean. So that means this is equal to the trace of psi adjoint rho AB. And the adjoint can go away. And then it turns out you can just, because this is a projector, we can square it, and then this just ends up being equal to psi rho AB psi. Okay, so this is a little bit of mathematical background, but when you work with super operators, just to remember that you're not doing anything new mathematically. You're doing exactly what you've been doing with regular linear operators, you're just acting on some Hilbert space, just the inner product is different. Yeah.
I'm still a little bit in the dark about the difference between completely positive and positive. Mm-hmm. Is it just in the Hilbert space we're acting, the positive map are like in the Hilbert space of A, like rho A, and the completely positive is on the combined Hilbert space of A and B.
Yeah, so completely positive is this picture. Completely positive is just saying that if I act on part of the system, I should get a valid. I'll give you an analogy. Again, most students don't really understand probability theory or haven't seen it, rather, I should say. But think about if I have a probability vector, the set of transformations I can apply to that are called permutations or mixtures of permutations. That's pretty much the most general thing you can do with a probability vector. If I give you a joint probability distribution for two different systems, so if I have a single die and then it has k outcomes with some probability pk each, then what I can do is I can permute those outcomes. But now what I want to say is that if I have a joint probability distribution of two events, and I apply my permutation map to one factor space of that joint system, I should get a valid probability distribution at the end. So it turns out that classically it's trivial that I think if it's a permutation, if it's kind of positive and that it preserves the probabilities, it's automatically completely positive in that if I only act on a part of a joint system, it still gives me a valid probability distribution out. But what's interesting, the mathematical structure of quantum mechanics is richer, and we have transformations that look like they're physical. So in other words, if I gave you this box, suppose we're living in a fictitious universe, and I gave you this box, and it actually had some positive, but not completely positive map. And I would say, I'm not telling you what's in this box. I want you to test it. I want you to tell me if this transformation is positive, if it's physically possible in our universe, okay? And then what you would do is you would input a wide variety of input states. In particular, you'd want a spanning set. And you'd make sure that the output you got each time was a valid physical state. And you would say, yeah, I confirm this box is a box that's physically possible in this universe because it preserves positivity. But then your friend next to you might say, ah, well, there's a different kind of test you didn't try. You didn't create some correlations between the input state and some other system, put this through, and then do joint measurements on both. And you might say, well, there's no way if it passed this test that it wouldn't pass that test. But it turns out there is a way. And so you can have boxes in this fictitious universe which allows positive transformations, which would not be possible in our universe because they wouldn't preserve positivity when you give it half of an input state, half of an entangled state. In fact, this is going to be a criterion for testing if something's entangled, not in the lab, but you know, in MATLAB or in Mathematica or on a piece of paper. And we'll get to that in a moment. Yeah?
How do you generalize to more than two systems?
That's a good question. I don't know that we need to. Let me think about that. I mean, in some sense, I guess, okay, here's how I would answer that. Tell me if this captures the spirit of your question. I can always imagine that each of these spaces are further divided into more factor spaces. So I can always imagine this identity is acting on, you know, two spin half particles. And I can imagine this map is acting on three spin one particles. So this is consistent with there being other. The idea is that for any such, I mean, the key point of this statement is that this is true. Okay, I didn't give you all the caveats I should have given you here, I realize. So this is true for any HB. So lambda acting on some Hilbert space is completely positive. If I can tensor it with identity acting on an arbitrary Hilbert space dimension. What's the basis? Oh, that's a great question. Oh, I should have mentioned that. Okay, so what's the basis? All right. Right? So there are lots of choices, and I'll give you a couple. It's any set of operators on an orthonormal basis. Okay, now it's orthonormal. If you're just happy with orthogonal, then we can just put a constant in here. Where the set BI span the space of linear operators. So a basis is a spanning set that's mutually orthogonal. And here we've normalized them. Okay, so I'm going to give you explicit examples in a minute, but let me just give you some of the formal properties. In particular, what this means is that we can decompose an arbitrary operator with respect to that basis. If I give you a vector psi in the original Hilbert space, and I give you a basis, 0 to d minus 1, then you can expand psi with respect to that basis by taking inner products to get the coefficients. Those coefficients go into the row vector, right? Or the column vector. So this means that any A, which is an element of our linear operators on this Hilbert space, admits an expansion A is equal to a sum over I, AI, BI, where AI is the inner product of BI with A, which literally means trace of BI adjoint A. And these are complex numbers. Okay, so now I've expanded. I mean, we could add hats here, because here A is a scalar, and these guys, A and B, are linear operators. So instead of hats, I'll just define exactly what these symbols mean, as I've just done there. So now we can do a decomposition. So we can express any element of the space in this way, and in particular, we can go to a matrix representation where we would write A as A1, A2, all the way up to A, well, let's call it D squared. So typically, if D is the symbol I use for the underlying Hilbert space dimension, then D squared is the dimension of the Hilbert space of linear operators that act on that Hilbert space of pure states. So what's a concrete example? I guess I'll move over here. So one very common example is the Pauli operators, or the Heisenberg-Weyl operators. So let's do some examples. This might help clarify things quite a bit for you. So consider the simplest case of a spin half particle. Okay, then our Hilbert space is C2, two-dimensional systems. We have the Pauli operators, which are identity x, y, and z. These are elements, these are linear operators. These are linear operators on C2. That means they themselves form a Hilbert space. The Hilbert space dimension is 4 because we have 4 elements, and these are a basis. Okay, so then we can expand any A, which is a linear operator on C2, can be written as A equals A1 identity plus A2 x plus A3 y plus A4 z. Here I'll use hats just for clarity. Okay, so this is for example, if A is a density operator, this is a common decomposition of a density operator. This defines essentially the Bloch sphere. What's missing? What have I done wrong here if I want to call these guys not just a spanning set, but an orthonormal basis? What am I missing? Normalization, exactly. It turns out X, Y, and Z are not they're orthogonal, but they're not orthonormal. So note the inner product between x and y is equal to the trace of x dagger y, which is equal to the trace of 0 x, and then what's y? It's like 0 I minus I 0. Okay, what's wrong?
The minus sign is half right.
Perfect, thank you. Okay, so now the trace of this. So first we do the standard matrix multiplication, and we get I 0, 0 minus I. Oh, sorry. Okay, this is showing the orthogonal. Okay, so the trace of this matrix, I guess I should have an extra bracket. The trace of this matrix is I plus minus I, which is 0. So I've just shown you the orthogonal. This is true for every pair. But I have to look at like x squared to get the normalization, right? So, but let's do it for identity, just for variety. And ease. So 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1. This is equal to the trace of 1, 0, 0, 1, which is equal to 2. But we delta ij, the Kronecker delta function, says this should be 1. So in fact, we did a normalization. So these form a basis. I should say, sorry, these form an orthonormal basis if we just define them as such. We define the orthonormal basis bi would be defined in terms of identity over 2, x. I thought it was the square root. It's a square root. Square root of 2. Y square root of 2, z over square root of 2. It's good stuff. All right. Yeah?
I've got a question and a comment. Firstly, it's a comment, it's just a question to check I'm correct. With the density operators, you have to set A1 equal 1, and then your other three the coordinates of the box for you, right?
A1 equals a half.
Oh, sorry, half.
Yeah. Well, sorry, yeah, sorry. It's, yeah, or you can absorb the... Yeah, but that's the basic idea. But the point is, A1 is fixed by normalization and orthonormality. So there's no freedom once you're dealing with properly normalized states and properly normalized basis. A1 is fixed to be a half. And then A2 and A3 and A4 then give you your parameters in the Bloch sphere. So I have some point in the middle of the Bloch sphere. This is some density operator. It's going to be characterized by... Well, I guess my notation's bad. I should have started counting from 0. And A1 is fixed by normalization. And in fact, of course, this is a bit wrong too, because here x, y, and z are not normalized as well. So you have to check your normalizations, and then that would tell you there's a scale factor, which is the radius of your Bloch sphere is determined by normalization. So this is what's going on with the Bloch sphere. It's just actually the expansion of the density operator with respect to an orthonormal basis in the Hilbert space. But that structure, the fact that we're dealing with the Hilbert space and that inner product, that's suppressed normally. People just present it as just a fact. But it turns out it's just a special case of a very convenient mathematical structure that helps you analyze problems. Yeah?
So two questions. Firstly, this basis is like a really nice basis to work with because you can take another basis, which is just like the component-wise one. You know, like put one in a component of one component of the matrix and put zeros everywhere else. That would form a basis, but it's not nearly as nice as this one because you have self-adjoint elements and then you don't get like your density matrices.
Yeah, this is a self-adjoint basis, which is nice, a basis of self-adjoint. Okay, so I'll show you that now. The Pauli operators, which are defined for a spin-half system, have the special property of being both self-adjoint and unitary.
Right.
So x, y, z identity are all, well, depends on how you normalize them if they're unitary. But up to normalization, they're self-adjoint and unitary. When you generalize the Pauli operators to higher dimensional systems, one of those two properties is lost. And I think it's the unitary part. They're still self-adjoint, but no longer unitary. So now let me show you a self-adjoint basis for an arbitrary dimension Hilbert space. I'll be doing this off the top of my head, so please make sure I don't make any typos. I'll do that.
top. Stop.
Oh, yeah? Good. Perfect. Thank you. All right, let's see if I can remember how to do this by heart. So the Heisenberg-Weil operators are a generalization of the Pauli operators. Sometimes they're called the generalized Pauli operators, in fact. And so we define a raising operator X, which is an element of the linear operator, is on some d-dimensional Hilbert space. And so here we have X acting on J is equal to J plus 1. And we have a phase operator Z acting on J, which gives us e to the I 2 pi J over D times J. I don't remember if by convention this has a minus sign or not, but I guess it's just a convention, so we don't have to worry about it. But now notice this difference here. J here, so here J, where J goes from 0 to D minus 1, is an orthonormal basis for CD, our Hilbert space, d-dimensional Hilbert space. And then what X does is it raises the state, and this is, I should say, this is true mod D. So if I have J equals D minus 1 and I apply X to it, then J plus 1 is D minus 1 plus 1 mod D. D mod D is 0, right? So that means that D is equal to 0, okay, because we're working mod D. So now these are the generators of a group, actually. No, that can't be true. Hold on a second. Yeah, they are generators of a group. Oh, right. So I guess it's the unitarity that's preserved and not the self-adjointness. I remembered it backwards. So now we can define P, AB, as X to the A, Z to the B, where A and B are scalars that run from 0 to D minus 1. And that generates D squared elements. Now, if we're trying to build an orthonormal basis for a space, if the space has dimension D squared, then you need D squared basis elements. So we've got the right number. And then we want to check the orthogonality, orthonormality. Let me just do this. I don't know if the normalization is D or square root of D. If it's square root of 2 there, then it's probably square root of D here. If we take D equals 2, we recover the Pauli operators. And then they become not just unitary, but also self-adjoint. So I added this square root of D. Please add that to your notes. Orthonormality is that we want the trace of PI dagger PJ to be equal to delta IJ. So that means we want to show that the trace of XA ZB dagger XA prime ZB prime is equal to delta AB A prime B prime. And we're going to have our square root of D here. And square root of D here. Yeah, I'm sure it's square root of D because if we take A equals 0 and B equals 0, we get the identity element, right? X to the 0 with power is just identity. Z to the 0 with power is just identity. So then we have trace of identity squared, which is trace of identity. Remember, these are operators acting on a d-dimensional Hilbert space, so they are d by d matrices. The trace of a d by d unit matrix is d. That d will cancel with these products of two square roots, and so we get 1. So that just would, so for example, you can check this, e.g., trace of x0, z0, x0, z0, which is just, and of course, there's a dagger here, which is just equal to the trace, let's write my square root of d, trace of identity squared, which is equal to the trace of identity. This is not the identity super operator, just the regular identity operator, over d, and this is equal to 1. There's actually a really nice way to do this based on what's called the symplectic inner product between AB and AB prime. But I won't be able to do it off the top of my head without seeing my notes on this, which are actually in these notes. I just don't have them printed out. But so there you go. So there's your orthonormal basis for a d-dimensional Hilbert space. Excuse me, your orthonormal basis for the linear operators on a d-dimensional Hilbert space, which is a d-squared dimensional Hilbert space. So yeah, I'm really glad that we went into these details because for those of you that end up working with linear superoperators, this is an enormously useful way to think about these things. And last but not least, I will tell you one thing. Most people introduce superoperators in terms of Krauss operators. Krauss operators are probably the least useful way to work with superoperators. So they're the most popular because they're historically the oldest, but also the least useful. So what do we know? If I tell you that lambda is some linear superoperator, and now I've just told you that it's actually acting on a Hilbert space, if I tell you so it's just some operator, some linear operator acts in a Hilbert space, and I say, now do a calculation in matrix representation, what would you do? Well, it's a linear operator. You would write it as a matrix with respect to a basis. So the most natural way to analyze linear superoperators is to pay attention to the fact that this is just third grade algebra. So lambda is a linear superoperator that means that we can write a matrix representation. And how do you do that? Well, this is a standard thing. You say, I choose some basis. And I can write a matrix, lambda ij are matrix elements. And I can write them as lambda ij is equal to the trace of bi dagger lambda acting on bj. So there you go. There's a matrix representation of lambda. And this is called the Liouville representation of the superoperator. And then the point is, then if I'm acting on some density operator, so now if I have the operation lambda rho is equal to sigma, this can be expressed as the matrix lambda ij acting on the column vector rho equals the column vector sigma, where the column vector rho is just rho 1, rho 2, rho 3, well, this is getting really sloppy, rho d squared. Okay, so let me just read this to you because I wrote it so poorly and I'm not going to rewrite it. This is rho 1, rho 2, rho 3, all the way down to rho d squared. And what are these guys? Okay, what's rho 3 here? Exactly. So rho I is equal to the inner product of bi with rho, which is just the trace of bi adjoint rho. So here, what I don't like about this notation I just gave you is that usually subscripts on rho refer to different instances of rho. So normally I use a subscript on an operator to refer to some different instance of that operator. But here each of these rho sub i's are scalars. They're just scalars, which are scalar elements of this. So the notation isn't as ideal as I would like it to be, but let me just emphasize that each of these guys are scalars. So here I'm using sigma and rho to be different instances of linear operators, and the subscript is referring to the fact that it's a scalar matrix element or column vector element. But so the point is then, I can analyze the action of a superoperator. Instead of writing this out as some clumsy Krauss operator decomposition, I can just write it as a matrix and just do, you know, basic linear algebra and get my answer out. And then once you have the components of sigma in this column vector format, you can just reconstitute sigma from its vector components by just writing it out with respect to its basis. So this is a far more, well, it depends. I mean, there's some calculations where maybe you want to use Krauss operators, but in the vast majority of cases, you just realize you're doing linear algebra because of this fact, this very useful fact. And then you just analyze it like you would any standard problem in linear algebra. Okay, I didn't get to tell you Krauss's representation theorem, but we'll get to that next class, I guess. Yeah, one last question. Yeah, I think that, you know, I haven't thought this through carefully in the case of infinite dimensional Hilbert space, which is, I guess, what this would be. So superoperators on infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces may or may not be expressible. I mean, because of this isomorphism between infinite dimensions, I'm a little bit worried that it would get complicated really fast. So I don't know for sure if this type of analysis would work in the infinite dimensional case. Yeah?
So it's there's something called the Hilbert-Schmidt operators, which is just like a reasonable class of operators, and you can define an inner product on them precisely as you've done. Mm-hmm.
That is the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product, yeah, actually. Yeah.
So Hilbert-Schmidt class operators are inner products based on this.
You know what? I remember that now. Thanks for reminding us.
They're probably dense they're probably dense in bounded operators under operators.
All right, well, you guys may continue that discussion later. Okay, thanks for your attention and enjoy the weekend. I'll see you on Monday.